This is Bird Note. The bearded reedling is a wetland songbird that's enjoying a boom in both population and popularity. The birds have rufous bodies, a light gray cap, and white faces. But bearded reedlings are named for the male's striking black facial markings that resemble a Fu Manchu mustache, or maybe make up for the rock band Kiss. It gives the bird a stern expression, at odds with their diminutive size. Barely larger than a chickadee, the male reedlings are often photographed with their feathers puffed out to near spherical proportions, their spindly legs grasping parallel stalks as if performing the splits. These images are so delightful that search results for roundest bird in the world serve up a gallery of reedlings. The internet's favorite borb is also a remarkable comeback story. Reedlings breed across much of Europe and Central Asia, but in the United Kingdom, where they're called bearded tits, a confluence of harsh winters and habitat loss reduced their numbers to just two pairs by the 1940s. Thanks to decades of intensive reed bed restoration and the bird's capacity to rear several broods in a season, there are now more than 600 breeding pairs of bearded reedlings in the UK today. So, don't be fooled by that adorable scowl. These wetland wonders can give us all something to cheer for. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me, as per usual, is Brandon. The reading we're doing is by Jan Zwicky. It's a lot of fun. Once Upon a Time in the West, what you'd think it's a Western, it kind of is. We decided to do it as this is a kind of a read-along and analyze episode, largely in part because of the style that Zwicky does.
It's very suitable for a kind of radio show. It's a read-along episode, but it's a read-along episode not just because it's like well-written or it's particularly good to actually read like the substance of it, but because it has tone. It has actual voice to it. It's a Western, and it's written with a Southern drawl, so it's very fun to just read out loud anyway.
It's fun to read out loud, and it gives... Zwicky is very impressive in going over the core concepts of some really, what I think a lot of people would describe as very difficult but seminal thinkers. And so through that, you're able to kind of have a fun sort of intro to them while also analyzing their key sort of ideas and, more importantly, their genealogy between them. It's sort of a story. But before we get to that, as our listeners know, we do our quote and quandary section to kind of open things up, which is our sort of not really necessarily related to the topic, where we either have a quote or a couple quandaries, sort of either, you know, obviously a quote is a quote that stood out to us. We talk about why our quandary is a kind of question or idea. I think both of us today have quandaries. Brandon, do you want to do yours first?
Sure, yeah. So I don't particularly know why. Maybe I do know why I've been thinking about this. Maybe it's some kind of like self-therapizing or just kind of... It kind of borders on self-therapizing and like cultural analysis, because this idea is one that kind of dominates, I suppose, the way that people think about themselves, view themselves. It's a relatively new idea, a new word that we've been using. And it's this idea of cringe, right? And a lot of people have been trying to like give an analysis of what cringe is. Is it just straightforward shame? Is it just embarrassment? Cringe seems to have a certain kind of structure to it. And a lot of people have tried to analyze like what specifically are the like what is the structure of cringe? Like when you experience cringe or when someone is cringy, like what's really going on? So one of the things that I've been thinking about in terms of or like in relation to cringe is there is this one condition that everyone seems to ascribe to cringe, which is that someone who is cringy, like it, one of the necessary conditions for being cringy is that you aren't aware of your being cringy, right? So like if someone is kind of like, you know, if they're in some like social setting or something and they're being cringy, there's a big difference between someone who's being embarrassing, which it seems to be like you can kind of know you're being embarrassing, but like, you know, you're putting yourself out there, something like that. But someone who's cringy doesn't realize that they're being cringy in that way, right? It almost seems to be like constitutive of it, right? The moment they become aware of it, they cease to be cringy. A lack of self-awareness seems to be like a core facet of cringe, at least like on a lot of people's analysis.
Well, immediately I think of, you know, if we think of something that people might consider kind of cringy, when it becomes sort of self-aware or intentional, we then kind of enter the annals of irony, right? This is sort of this intentional irony going on, right? Where that cringe becomes sort of, as you said, it's no longer kind of authentic in its kind of lameness or like loserness or whatever you want to call it, and instead is like intentionally trying to bring about those feelings, but in a manufactured, synthetic way.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. There's a big difference between someone who is like genuinely and legitimately cringy and someone who like kind of has caught on to the zeitgeist of cringe and is trying to make like, you know, cutting edge art or something by being cringy. Well, you can tell that one is very manufactured. But my quandary specifically is taking up this condition, right? Because if it has to do with knowing that you're cringe, it's an epistemic condition, right? So we can do an epistemology of cringe. Now, I actually kind of have a problem with this condition because I don't necessarily know if it is a condition, like a necessary condition. But this is what's so problematic about it is because it does seem to be. But then there's this counterexample, right? So I had a friend who sent me a comic, and it's a 3-panel comic, and it's like a person, and it starts with them, you know, kind of like sobbing at themselves a little bit because they're writing self-insert fan fiction, which is when you kind of just like make up a story and you put yourself into this fantasy that you want to have, and it's super self-indulgent. So in the first panel, the person is writing it and they're like looking at this and be like, man, my self-insert fan fiction is so cringe. And then in the second panel, a figure approaches, to which they look up. And then in the third panel, it's revealed who it is. And the writer says, oh my God, Dante Alighieri. And Dante is kind of like giving this reassuring smile, like, don't worry, you know, I'm one of the West's greatest authors. And everything I wrote was self-insert, you know. So don't feel bad about writing self-insert fan fiction. It's a funny comic, but I bring it up because it raises a problematic for me. And it's in that first panel, which is realizing that you are cringe, which is possible, right? You can realize that you are cringe. But the question is, if it's possible to realize that you are cringe, or that something you did was cringe, or that it's possible to realize you are being cringy, what happens to the thing that you realized if unawareness of it is a condition for it, right? Like, you can see there's a paradox or a problem. On the one hand, we really do have moments where we realize something we said was cringe. And that's, like, the whole part of, like, I think the kind of self-reflexive and hyper-reflexive concern with cringe and why we're obsessed with it is, like, oh, my God, am I cringe? And so we all want to know whether we're being cringe or not. On the other hand, you can't, like, by definition, it's not possible to know, because not knowing is constitutive of it. So we're in this is like the, you know, internet's kind of epistemic crisis at the moment, in a way.
I really like bringing Dante in there as well, though, because it's like, yeah, as soon as you insert, like, it's like, oh, inserting myself into this sort of like Harry Potter or video game or Star Wars fan fiction. Oh, initially that sounds cringy, but like on the face of it, like obviously, as you said, as our listeners may or may not be aware, Dante famously wrote a series of religious themed texts where he was inserted himself as like a traveler through the different levels of heaven and hell. You know, basically like the most intense sort of insertion possible on a universal scale.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the text explicitly, like in the scholarship around Dante, they make a distinction between Dante the Pilgrim and Dante the Writer, right? And the writer very much so acknowledges like the pilgrim in the story. So he's very aware that he's writing himself into these stories. So that's kind of the joke of like Dante was writing self-insert fan fiction. Also because there is like a marriage at the end of it. That's why it's called the Divine Comedy. You know, he gets what he wants. It's kind of a fantasy.
I really like that one. I really like that one. Should I move on to my own quandary? So recently I've had some time off work and I've been kind of just studying or kind of learning lots of different subjects. So looking at lots of different subjects that are interesting. And one of them is the sort of study of the academic study of religion and the sociology and psychology of religion. There's all sorts of different ways you can take on to this or whatever. This is a huge subject. But one area that I recently watched a little essay, a video essay on failed prophets or failed prophetic, what's the word I'm looking for? Claims, right? So like, say, you know, like when a preacher or some sort of individual says that the world is going, it usually has to do with the rapture. Like that's the big one. The big claim is always that the rapture is coming at this date and such and such and such, right? And as far as we know, the rapture hasn't happened yet, and yet history is absolutely full, going as far back as recorded history, but easily well back into early Christianity, because for maybe our listeners don't know, most early Christian sects believe that, you know, the rapture or the end times, the rapture is actually a more modern term, but the end times were like very near, that they were going to happen in their lifetime, all this kind of stuff. Obviously, it didn't come to be. So you have all sorts of preachers, and it is particularly came about, speaking of cringe, because recently on TikTok, there's been this trend of preachers and religious leaders claiming to know dates or claiming to, you know, prophesize a rapture coming at X date or whatever, right? What I found most interesting about this, or really what the essay was about, what I found most interesting was not so much people making these claims, people make these claims all the time, was that larger religious groups, when making these claims, obviously when the claims don't come true, we immediately assume the automatic judgment would be that these religious groups fall apart, right? So if I'm the leader of some sort of religious organization or religious group or cult or whatever you want to call it, and I say on X date, the world is going to end, and then that date comes and nothing happens. And in many cases, many religious groups have made great preparations, and individuals have made great, which we'll kind of get into, have made great personal sacrifices with the expectation that calling is correct. But what the research finds is that actually, in most cases, these groups do not disintegrate after a failed rapture claim or after a failed prophetic claim. I personally found that to be really, really interesting. Like, why you would think that, if I've got this religious leader, he's supposed to be this really special guy connected to the Lord or connected spiritually somehow, and then, he gives us this really, really like kind of like the most important calling possible, and then it turns out to be a failure. One would think that would kind of be the end. So this moves, I think, there's an interesting move here from religion being less of a psychological phenomena to more of a sociological phenomena. And that basically there's a bunch of, and there's been a lot of research actually around this apparently, about how, in fact, there's all sorts of strategies or situations or conditions that allow these groups to continue and sometimes to even benefit from what would seem to be a massive failure. So the strategies involved often have to deal with rationalization. So basically, basically what that means is that, you're a member of this group, we're a member of a group, there's been this failed prophecy, it looks like a big embarrassment. The group then goes through a process of rationalization. How could this be incorrect? And one of the ways that they go through that, or there's actually a few of them, but one of them is actually one of the most interesting ones I find, is to spiritualize, the leader will spiritualize that prophetic failure. Interestingly, in the essay that I was watching, host called this the Jesus move, which basically means I took upon myself all the pain and suffering and, stuff that was supposed to come, and I embodied it in my own being and therefore saved everyone from the end times. So basically the leader is able to make this sort of move where that's the Jesus move. Basically, I absolve everyone of all their, everyone absolved of all their sins because I sort of take up that negative energy, take up that power, and I embed it in myself. And because I'm such a spiritually powerful being, I'm able to emanate and move through it. So that's another one. Another one is actually blame. And this is another kind of sociological one where basically becomes the group becomes in this process, there's often a tightening of the group where the group basically says, it didn't happen because we failed. Because we didn't believe hard enough. Famously, the Jehovah's Witness Church in the 1970s, the leader of the Watchtower at the time, which is the sort of like head of the Jehovah's Witness church, group or whatever, they claimed that there was going to be a rapture in the 1970s. And when that didn't happen, they turned around and basically said to their, their worldwide congregation, the reason that it didn't happen is because you all believed it was going to happen. It was so basically it's your fault. You all have to take the blame. You all have to take the burden of this prophecy not coming true. So again, this is another really interesting way of sort of disseminating out this really odd failure, or kind of just like almost like psychotic move, and like pushing it out to the group, and in the process of doing it, binding the group closer together, because all the members then become members of this failed process. So there was that one, and then there was a couple more. Basically, there's the cultural environment. So this is a kind of an obvious one, but especially when groups are quite large, or if they're very tightly knit, or if the members themselves are very tightly knit with each other, then there's what's called by sociologists the cultural environment. Basically, that the weight of the failure of the prophecy is not nearly enough to break apart the culture that's been created that made this prophetic declaration, right? So basically, the system is so big and so important to everyone, if it involves your, you know, if it involves your personal life, your spiritual life, your life at home, your friends, your family, your activities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then a failed prophecy is sort of something that can kind of go off with the wind. It looks bad, it is bad, but at the end of the day, the group is far more important and holds it together. And again, it's this binding process. And then finally, I had one more here that says, yeah, it's just water under the bridge. So yeah, so I thought those were really interesting, because these are more like, rather than focusing on how individuals deal with, you know, a failed prophecy from their leader, or if they're in a religious group, what seems to be far more important is the sociological and group dynamics that allowed those positions to be weathered, and for oftentimes those conditions to create a system that is stronger than it was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting case, especially like you make this contrast between, we're usually surprised by people who act irrationally in these ways, but you say that there's something illuminating about looking at like sociological structures and stuff like that. I think it has to do with the bias, the sort of like Cartesian bias we have towards things like cognitions and beliefs, that we usually ascribe mental phenomena to discrete individuals, and we usually think that people believe in isolation, but that's not really true. In fact, beliefs have to be constituted by durable structures for there to be beliefs about, right? So if you can create durable structures like social structures and stuff like that, and those social structures can withstand a change in belief, well, obviously the belief is gonna survive in some way as well, and along with it, you know, the social group.
Yeah, like, let me give one more example and then we'll kind of move on. But there was another group, a splinter Christian, you know, kind of religious group that had that prophesized in the 1980s that, you know, the end times were coming, that there was going to be a nuclear war between the US and the Soviet Union, and that basically this group spent millions of dollars building a bunker. They built a bunker, and they spent 42 days in this bunker without leaving, this entire group. I don't know the size of the group, but I'm going to assume it was at least a few dozen people, if not more. And when obviously the nuclear war didn't happen, and after 42 days of staying in this bunker, they left, what ended up happening is that became a, basically the group was, those who studied that group, the group was extremely strengthened by that process, because they basically said that they had gone through a test together. They had gone through this whole process together. They were bound living in this crappy little bunker for 42 days together. And that therefore, not only did they save the world in their minds through their ultimate test of faith, but they also came out far closer together than they did when they came in, right? And again, those are relating to those sociological structures where it's far less about what any individual thinks and far more about how those individuals interact and believe in and relate to one another in terms of how they understand their own identity, to the extent that that identity becomes something less of a person and more like an actual individual and more just like identifying entirely with the group. You know, you see that with cults and stuff all the time where it's like, you know, the individual is broken down to such an extent that like their own individuality is an extremely thin strip. And instead what you have is a member in a much thicker group dynamic.
That's also epistemic as well, right? Certain conditions under which beliefs endure in a way.
And how those beliefs have to be shared beliefs, right? Like individuals just believing something on their own, although we've talked about this before, in complete isolation, one, is that even really possible epistemically to have a belief that's completely isolated? But two, most beliefs rely on some sort of social relationship for that belief to even make sense or have an importance to the believer.
Yeah, I'm reminded a long time ago I brought up Zizek in terms of beliefs and whatnot, and I was really interested in Zizek's like kind of materialist reading of how beliefs form in terms of like, you know, material environments and whatnot. And he draws on Blaise Pascal, and Pascal is talking about you know, if you're an atheist and you want to be a believer, just do the stupid rituals, just make the stupid signs, just say the stupid words. They don't mean anything to you. That doesn't matter. Just do them. And eventually you'll find yourself embedded in a social structure that is the condition for the support of those beliefs. And eventually you will say to yourself, well, there has to be some reason I'm just doing these meaningless gestures. It must be because I believe, and then you'll believe.
Fake it till you make it, right? And that's often how a lot of cults work, right? Like a lot of times, you know, it's sort of the process of, well, just join in, just like, you know, do these little things with us, just enjoy, you know, you can leave at any time, but those activities, those beliefs, once you start participating in them more and more, they have more and more meaning to you as an individual because they become part of effectively who you are and your social relationships.
So where we left off on the previous episode, as far as our reading of Once Upon a Time in the West, we largely traced out the history that Zwicky thought was important for leading up to her kind of main subject, which is Heidegger. I mean, the subtitle of the essay is Heidegger and the Poets. She's going to eventually, this is all stage setting for talking about Heidegger's relationship to poets and what that does for Heidegger's philosophy. So that history consisted of a few main characters: David Hume, Immanuel Kant, and George Hegel. She does a pretty bang up job of explaining, you know, transcendental idealism with a southern drawl. It's a pretty passable understanding of Kant's philosophy, but these characters are actually cast as Dave Hume, Manny Kant, and just George, at which point we get to Marty Heidegger.
This is where Zwicky comes back, and you know, just for our listeners from the last episode, she, you know, introduces Marty Heidegger early on and then kind of basically says, we've got to backtrack, though, to get to him, to get to kind of what he's getting at and his whole idea with the poets. We need to go, and as you said, we need to go through Davy Hume and Manny Kant and George being Hegel. Which brings us to this fella, Marty Heidegger. Sorry, we're kind of skipping over some other guys who you've called in at this saloon in between, but Fred Nietzsche, Ed Husserl, and them other boys, they're mostly just yelling, "Set 'em up, George." This boys, they're mostly just yelling, "Setting up, boys." Anyways, this Heidegger fella, he comes in and has a drink or two, and George is still pouring. Shoots the shit a while, and then he says, "Fellas, time we called this dicking around quits. This crap about who's with what gang, do Ed's boys grind their coffee finer than Fred?"